All right, so we are in the book of Leviticus. So we'll get a little introduction here. And so, again, maybe a book that if you do a Bible in a year, you kind of get to and you're glad to get out of after a little while. I don't know. But a lot of good stuff still in here in Leviticus. And so, again, we'll touch on this is just kind of our overview. So don't worry, we're not going to read through like all the laws and all that and go piece by piece. We'll get some big picture ideas and just, again, hone in on certain parts, kind of like what we did with Exodus last time. Okay, so a little quicker than what we did with Genesis, but it'll be good with that. So kind of introduction, just some of the kind of basics here, title of the book. We get Leviticus from kind of, once again, like the Latin Vulgate, their translation, which comes from the Greek version, the Septuagint, which titles it Leviticon. And so that Greek title has kind of the idea in it of that which concerns the priests or Levites. Okay, that which concerns the priests or Levites, that's what that term means. And as I'm sure you can kind of understand, that's kind of a fitting title because there is a lot in here that regards the priests and Levites and kind of their roles and duties. But there's more to it than that, as we'll see. There's more to it than that. It's not just that, but it is an important part of the book, and so kind of a fitting title. The Hebrew title is once again kind of drawn from the opening words of the Hebrew text, and so their title is Vayikra, which just translates means, and he called. Okay, and so if you're looking at Leviticus 1:1, you'll see like in our English, it says like the Lord called, and so it's again just taken from that initial kind of word there, and he called. And so the significance of that, just like we saw with Exodus, that starting with kind of that conjunction and, which we don't really have in our English translations, but we have in the Hebrew, shows this kind of continuation of the narrative, okay, that we're just picking up right where we left off. And we see that, if you remember Exodus, we ended with the building of the tabernacle, and then the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle, and we kind of left off there. And now you have, at the beginning of Leviticus, God calling out to Moses from the tabernacle. And so we're just kind of picking up right where he left off. God's plan is moving forward and all of that. Okay? Just as we've seen. All right. So that's kind of titles. Theme of the book, of what we could say is this theme. What I think is a fitting way to say this is, the God who is holy and demands holiness. So the God who is holy and demands holiness. So it's kind of this fitting summary of the book of Leviticus. And we're going to see just this on clear display that the Lord is holy, okay, that he is a holy God, and as such, he demands holiness from his people. And so you can think of like passages that really, like a passage that really encapsulates that is Leviticus 19:2, which is that statement like, you shall be holy, for I, the Lord your God, am holy. And so again, you see that this desire, this demand for holiness is ultimately rooted in the holiness of God. So he is holy and demands holiness from his people. And if you kind of remember last time we left off the book of Exodus, with this question, right, where you have the tabernacle being built, God, the glory of the Lord filling the tabernacle, and we left off with this question of, well, how is this going to work? Because now you have this holy God dwelling with sinful people. And if you kind of remember, even in Exodus, God even told Moses, like, hey, I'm not going to go through the promised land because I'm just going to kill all of you if I do, right? Like, you're just stubborn people. Like, it's not going to work. But then Moses interceded, pleaded, and God said, okay, I will go, but you're left with this question of, well, how's this going to work? And so Leviticus is answering that. And in a very kind of foundational sense, kind of the simplified answer here is, how's this work? You need to be holy, okay? You need to be holy, and that's what Leviticus is going to show, okay? And then you kind of have the structure there, just kind of an outline of breaking up in the various kind of chunks here of laws concerning sacrifices, the consecration of the priests, the clean and unclean items, Day of Atonement, all these different things, okay? And so there isn't like a set kind of outline that we've seen like in Genesis and Exodus as much, but we kind of can group these laws all together in those different sections, and that gives that outline that you have there. All right, so let's get into Leviticus itself. So the first seven chapters there, kind of that first point, is referring to laws concerning sacrifices. Laws concerning sacrifices. And so, again, Leviticus starts out strong with just giving a bunch of sacrifices and kind of the process of what you would offer for different things. But before getting into the specific ones, there's five. Okay, there's five main ones we're going to talk about, five sacrifices that are mentioned here in these first seven chapters. But before getting into the specific ones, I just wanted to point out a couple things here as kind of an introduction into these sacrifices. The first thing is, I think when we normally think of sacrifices, we normally always associate them as being like a sacrifice for sin. That the reason people are offering sacrifices is because of sin. And while that's true, that's some of it, what we're going to see here is that's not all of the sacrifices. Okay, that actually out of the five that we're going to cover, only two of them actually deal with sin. Okay, the other three do not. They're offered in different circumstances and are actually more just kind of acts of worship, more so than like offering because of sin. And so on a foundational level, that kind of shows us that what, life is more than just kind of like this dealing with the sin kind of aspect, but it's a life of worship. Okay, that we see that even in the sacrifices, that there's sacrifices that are involving worship, not just, oh, I'm atoning for sin in some way. Okay, so keep that in mind, and we'll kind of point those out. That's more than just dealing with sin, it's worship. And then second thing I kind of want to point out in terms of sacrifices kind of ties into, if you remember last time, where we talked about kind of the role of the Mosaic Law in general, the Mosaic Covenant. Do you guys remember kind of the purpose of the Mosaic Covenant? If you were here a couple weeks ago, what kind of the main purpose is to do what?
Restore a relationship between God and man.
Okay, restore relationship a little bit, yeah. It could do that, but more specifically, kind of even the word Torah. Do you remember what that kind of means? To do what? Not quite. It involves the law. Oh, maybe not quite. We're getting there. Getting warm. Starts with a T. Ends in each. Teach. Yeah, to teach. To teach or instruct. Okay, that was really the purpose of the law. The term Torah really has this idea of instruction. It's to teach. And so what we talked about was the Mosaic Law, the covenant, was really meant to instruct. It was meant to teach. And the primary thing that it was meant to teach or instruct you about was not how to be saved, if you guys remember that. It was not how to be saved, but rather it was to point you to that which does save you. Okay, and we kind of use the example of like an exit sign of a building, where if the building's on fire, clinging to the exit sign, is that going to save you? No, you're going to get burnt to a crisp, right? The purpose of an exit sign is not meant to save you. It is meant to point you to the way that does save you. If you leave this door, you'll be fine. Okay, and same with the Mosaic Law. The Mosaic Covenant was never meant to be a thing of like, oh yeah, keep all the commandments so then you get salvation. But rather, the point of the Mosaic Covenant was to point you to that which does save. And part of that was to show you like, you're not going to be able to keep this. You're not going to be able to keep all these laws, all that. Okay, and so part of this, being part of this covenant, these sacrifices are meant to instruct. They're meant to teach. And so what they do teach is this aspect that, yeah, sin requires sacrifice. Okay, that there is a sacrifice that is required because of your sin. But what we see throughout this is, were these animals, like, were these sacrifices something that led to, like, you actually eternally being forgiven? No, because what? You had to keep sacrificing over and over again. That was, like, the point in Hebrews. The writer of Hebrews kind of brings up the blood of animals can never take away sin. And that's evidenced by the fact that you keep having to sacrifice. It keeps happening. Okay, you keep having to do it. And so what you begin to see, though, but on a foundational level, you understand that, yes, sacrifice needs, or sin needs a sacrifice to cover it, to atone for the sin. Okay, and that it's going to point us to kind of this, an ultimate sacrifice, something that will be able to accomplish this forgiveness of sin, to where there is no more repetition of the need for sacrifices. Okay? Does that make sense? All right. And then the third kind of point here as well when we talk about sacrifices is that they're not only supposed to teach and instruct Israel, but we're also supposed to be something that would be on display to the nations around them. Okay? That as they do all this, as they go through all these intricate offerings and all that, as people witness this and wonder, like, why do you do this? It's then an opportunity for them to explain, like, it's because our God is holy and he demands holiness. Okay, and like you kind of build off of that. All right, so that's just some little background to keep in mind as we kind of go through these sacrifices. And so the first sacrifice we come to is the burnt offerings. The burnt offerings. And this is one of those sacrifices that is not for sin, but rather just like kind of for worship. And in this sacrifice, the whole animal is burnt upon the altar. And the emphasis of this offering is to kind of denote total consecration to God. And so, which is why like the whole animal is burnt on the offering. Okay, the worshiper is essentially stating that they are wholly devoted to the Lord. That is the point of these burnt offerings. Okay, and it mentions like atonement in there, but kind of the that seems to be not so much atoning for sin, but again, rather this idea of being 100% set apart for God and being consecrated for him. Okay. And so, again, this is this act of worship where they are dedicating themselves to fully follow the Lord. Okay, that's what these burnt offerings are for, kind of this act of worship. The second one, grain offerings. This is another sacrifice of worship. So, again, not dealing with sin yet. And the main purpose of the offering was kind of an act of thanksgiving for the Lord's provision. Okay. So this often involved thanking God for like the first fruits of your crop. So people would kind of bring a portion of that first fruits and sacrifice to the Lord. Again, this act of worship, thanking him for his provision. And that's really the goal of this, this offering. Okay. And this would also, sometimes a portion of it would be given to like the priests for them to eat as well. And so kind of providing, that provision for them as well. Through these grain offerings. Peace offerings. These, again, were offered kind of this idea of giving thanks or maybe part of a vow or even just freely wanting to worship the Lord. Again, we're still in the context of sacrifices of worship, not, again, atoning for sin yet. And these, the fat of the animal would be burned on the altar. And kind of the reason for that is back in that time, the fat of the animal is considered kind of like the choice part of the animal. And so the idea being you are giving the best to the Lord there. And then with the remaining meat, most people kind of take it like largely like the priests were given some of the food and then the worshiper would eat with the priest. And so essentially you kind of have like this fellowship meal, which is why sometimes people refer to this as like the fellowship offering. This peace offering, this fellowship offering. And so you're celebrating not only your relationship with God on the one hand, but on the other hand, you are celebrating your relationship with one another. Okay, so that's what these peace offerings, their fellowship offerings are referring to. Okay, and then four, you now have the sin offerings, which as I'm sure you can guess, these involve sin, right? And atoning for sin. So very aptly named here, we are dealing with the sin offerings. But before getting into the details, if you look at verse 2 of chapter 4, if you're kind of working through here in Leviticus, chapter 4 is where we're kind of at now, laws for sin offering. In verse 2, do you catch like what sins are mentioned here? What sins are kind of being dealt with the sin offering? What was that?
Unintentional.
Yeah, unintentional sin. So notice that it says, like, if anyone sins unintentionally. Okay, and kind of an interesting fact of, as we're going to deal with, like, the sin offerings as well as the guilt offerings, they all involve sins done unintentionally. Okay, and like they use the language, and even like the guilt offerings in a moment we'll talk about, use that same language of, yeah, if you do something and then you realize later like that you have wronged someone or done something, like then you act, right? And so it's all done kind of unintentional. And so what this kind of means, and it's kind of interesting here, is that in these five offerings, like if you sin intentionally, that there's really no sacrifice within the system to deal with that. And so kind of the question is, well, what are you supposed to do then? Because as I'm sure you can relate in your life, probably a lot of your sins are intentional, right? That's not like, oh, that's rare that I perform intentional sins, right? Like, no, like that happens. And so so what are you supposed to do with that? And so that's kind of like an open-end question a little bit here, and like we'll see as we come through. But we'll see later on in Leviticus, there's kind of like a catch-all kind of event that we'll talk about that does kind of like deal with this a little bit. But you can start to see how this system is pointing to something better. It's pointing to something greater. Something that can deal with not only unintentional sins, but also intentional ones and deal with them permanently. Okay, so you can start to see those elements of how the Mosaic Covenant and even the laws within them are starting to point to that which will actually save you, right? That'll point to, as we know later on, like the Messiah, Christ, and the sacrifice that he'll accomplish on the cross, okay? All right, so the details of the sin offering itself. So depending upon who you were, so like the priests would offer different different sacrifices, the leaders would offer different, the common people would offer a little bit different. So depending who you were kind of dictated which animal and stuff you would sacrifice with all this. But what you would do is you'd bring the animal and you would lay your hands on the animal, that kind of process where you're then kind of linking yourself with this animal, essentially, and showing that this animal is being slaughtered because of your sin, okay? That it is bearing the punishment that your sin deserved, that it is taking that sacrifice in your place, and which is this idea of kind of that substitutionary atonement, okay? Like even more specifically, like penal substitution, right? This idea of deserving this punishment, that this animal is bearing that judgment I deserve. Okay, and that laying on the hands is kind of symbolizing that, showing that they are taking my place, essentially. My sin deserves death, but they are taking that. And it's kind of interesting as you read through kind of the descriptions of the sin offerings, they seem to have some elements that kind of almost seem to combine the burnt and peace offerings, where you have kind of sometimes like a combination of the two. And for example, sometimes like the fat is burned in all the offerings, just like the peace offering was. Then with some of the sacrifices, the rest of the body is burned, and in others, the rest of the body is eaten by the priests. And so some people kind of argue that what's kind of this is intentional to show that kind of this idea of the sin offering is you're now being brought back to like dedicating yourself to the Lord, like the burnt offering would do. And also you now have your relationship with God kind of restored in that peace with him, which would be like that peace offering. Okay, that they kind of identify. That's why you have kind of this combination of multiple, because it's like, okay, this sin offering is now dedicating you to the Lord, but also kind of restoring that relationship and having peace with God. Okay, does that make sense? All right, and so, right, so kind of your sin is not only dealt with, but now you're also consecrated to God, right, and you're at peace with him. And so, again, you can see the elements where if you zoom ahead thousands of years, right, to the time of Christ, and even like Paul, how he describes the work of Christ, did his work only deal with our sin? No, like it led to what? A restored relationship with God. We now have peace with God. That's like Romans 5, talks about now we are justified, we have peace with God in different things. And so kind of in a similar way down the road, you see that ultimate sacrifice of Christ kind of does the same thing. Okay? All right, and the last sacrifice here to talk about are the guilt offerings. So again, these are also in reference to dealing with sin, but again, dealing with unintentional sins still. And the main difference between the guilt offering and the sin offering is the issue of restitution. Okay, it's kind of like the idea of restitution. And so this involved dealing with the consequences of your sin. Okay, this involved dealing with the consequences of sin. So if you wrong someone in some way, you not only offered a sacrifice, but then you also made restitution for them for the wrong you have done. Okay, and so that's kind of the distinction a little bit here between the sin and the guilt offering. And again, keep making some of these connections. Zoom forward in the Old Testament, right? You have Isaiah chapter 53, where that should hopefully be somewhat familiar passage. It's the passage of the suffering servant, where you see clearly that the Messiah would have to suffer and die for the sins of his people. And it's interesting that in that passage, in verse 10 of chapter 53, we see the mentioning that he will make a guilt offering for his people, that his sacrifice will be this guilt offering. And so it's showing that Christ's sacrifice not only deals with what? Our sin, but also the consequences of our sin. And so really, he deals with the collateral damage and everything of our sins, right? He deals with all of it. And so that's kind of the point there of why in Isaiah 53 chooses to talk about being a guilt offering, because it's more than just the sin. It's even like the consequences of it. It's all of it he deals with. He bore it all on the cross. Okay. All right. So then we had, those are the offerings. And then the next couple chapters are essentially then giving the instructions to the priests of kind of their role in handling all of these various sacrifices. And so so it's the worshiper as well as the priest have to both understand kind of what's going on here, okay, and what their different responsibilities are. And so this really shows that the whole process is holy. Okay, and so the way you become holy needs to also be holy. And so we have to, the priests have to understand their role specifically to accomplish all of this. Okay, we good? All right, so that's the sacrifices. The next couple chapters, point number two, kind of main outline here, is the consecration of the priests. The consecration of the priests. And so with all these laws now in place about the sacrifices, you need to consecrate the priests so they can actually offer the sacrifices, okay? So again, you see this element of kind of the holiness of God on display, where every part needs to be holy. And so not only is the process of the sacrifice need to be holy, the people who are the mediators, the priests who are offering these sacrifices, need to be set apart. They need to be consecrated and holy. And that's what you have in these chapters, okay? And so you see Aaron and his sons are consecrated to serve as priests. And so again, the emphasis is on the holiness of the Lord here, because again, they need to be holy as well. And so you have kind of them offering sin offerings and burnt offerings on behalf of Aaron and his sons to fully consecrate them to the Lord. And this process actually ends up taking like 7 days for them to kind of do all this. So significant time there. But then we see that the Lord then accepts Aaron's offering. Okay, so after this consecration has taken place, Aaron and his sons essentially offer all the sacrifices except the guilt offering, almost seeming like a test run here of kind of making sure they do all of it right. And they perform all those offerings, and we see the Lord accept it, okay? And so in chapter 9, though, in verse 24, you see this language, if you're there, when they offer these things, it says in verse 24, "And fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the pieces of fat on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted and fell on their faces." And so just keep that in mind, that phraseology, this fire came out from before the Lord and consumed these sacrifices. Okay, this is the Lord accepting these sacrifices. All right, And then chapter 10, we have this story of Nadab and Abihu, which are two of the sons of Aaron. So part of the priests who were just consecrated, a little different word there, consecrated in the previous chapter. We have the story of involving them, where the story kind of goes, they both took a censer and put fire in it, and they laid some incense on it and offered. Notice what it says there in verse 1 of chapter 10. What did they offer? Strange fire or unauthorized fire before the Lord. And so we're not exactly sure of what that means, like what they actually did. But the rest of verse 1 makes it clear. It says, which, like, the Lord had not commanded them. So we don't know exactly what it was, but it was a deviation from the norm in some way. It was something that the Lord had not commanded them to do. And so you kind of have to understand, if it's not exactly the way God wanted it, it's not holy. It's strange. It's unauthorized. Okay? And do you guys remember what happens to them? They got consumed, right? So notice verse 2, and fire came out from before the Lord and consumed them. Notice the same phraseology that we saw in chapter 9, and the fire came out from before the Lord and consumed the burnt offering. So it uses that same kind of phraseology to kind of show that what? Like, they became the sacrifice, essentially. And so if you don't offer the right sacrifice, you become the sacrifice. That's really what's being shown here. And we see the point of this in verse 3, where Moses says to Aaron, this is what the Lord has said, among those who are near me, I will be sanctified. And before all the people, I will be glorified. And so this has to do with what? God's holiness. Right? He says, those who draw near to me, I will be sanctified. I will be holy. So these priests, like, you are to treat me as the holy God I am. Okay? And he will be glorified before all the people. And then notice Aaron's response. Well, it says, and Aaron held his peace. Right? He just lost two of his sons, but he knew that God was right. Okay, there was no argument he could make against that. Like, he knew, like, God was right. Like, this is what needed to happen. And this is just a reminder, I think, for us, like, the fact that, like, the nature of God's holiness is sovereign. Like, we don't get a choice in what is considered holy or not. Okay, God has determined how you are to be holy, and there's no arguing or deviating from that. And I think that's important for us to recognize, because even, like, a common thought today with people is we kind of have this thought of, like, why can't I get to God on my own terms, right? Like, I can just find my own way to God. Like, what does it matter if I'm Christian or some other religion or whatever, right? Like, as long as I'm getting to God, what's wrong with that? And what you start to see, like, in Leviticus and passages like this, it's because the way you become holy must be holy. And that's the only way that satisfies God's holy justice, right? Is the way he has determined what is holy. That is what it is. That's the bar. That's the standard. There is no other. Okay? And we see that on display here with Nadab and Abihu, the seriousness of that. All right. And then the next few chapters, kind of handful of chapters here, 11 to 15, we have this section of kind of the clean and unclean, various animals or different things. And really what we see from these chapters is that God demands holiness in every aspect of our lives. Whether it's something as kind of seemingly mundane as the food you eat, or to, like, the high points of life, like childbirth, or even in matters of, like, personal, like, kind of health issues and everything, whatever the case is, God demands holiness from his people. And that's really the nature of all these laws. And so God's people will be distinct in how they act in each of these areas. Okay? And it's important to also reference, like, as you read through the section, when you refer to things that are, like, clean and unclean, don't equate that as like right and wrong or sin and not sin. Okay? Something being unclean is not necessarily like wrong or sinful. Okay? But rather it has to do more with that kind of ceremonial, relational aspect between you and God, okay? To where if you are unclean, then like you couldn't enter certain areas, right? Like of the temple or go near God in different ways until you were ceremonial clean again, okay? But I think sometimes we kind of associate those as like, oh, if someone's unclean, that means like they're sinful or something like that. And that's not the case here, okay? But it just has more of that kind of ceremonial aspect, that kind of closeness with God in that way. Okay? All right. Yeah, like for example, like even like when you think of like the different foods, like they weren't allowed to eat certain animals. We know from like the New Testament that there's nothing inherently wrong with like the animals themselves. That's why like you have like God declaring all foods clean. And that's why we're not doing that. That's why we eat bacon and other stuff like that. But rather like in this time, there are things that were clean or unclean. And so their diet, right, was designed with kind of a theological purpose, okay, to, again, stand out to other people. And so some animals were considered unclean because, like, for example, like they weren't supposed to eat like scavengers, and probably because those things were associated with like death. And so we don't eat those. And so like there's different things, and like they would, again, it would stand out to the people around them, like, oh, why doesn't your whole nation eat pigs or whatever, right? Like, and they have a vehicle to talk with people about all that. Okay. All right, so even in their food, they're putting on display God's glory and holiness. That's kind of chapter 11. Chapter 12 has to do with kind of like I mentioned before, like childbirth. So even in like the high points of life, having the birth of a child, there is still a demand for holiness. And then chapters 13 through 15 have to deal with kind of leprosy and other kind of like bodily discharges of kind of what to do with that. And so again, even in the most kind of intimate or personal things in life, your kind of physical health and all that, God is to be shown as holy in all of it. Okay, in how they act, how they conduct themselves, he is to be shown to be holy. And that's, again, what we see God emphasizing all throughout Leviticus. And it's this demand on the people because it's ultimately rooted in what? His holiness. He is the holy God and therefore demands holiness from his people. All right, and that leads us into chapter 16. Kind of our next big thing here is the Day of Atonement. The Day of Atonement. And maybe you guys have heard of this, kind of a familiar part. This is one of the most significant parts of the book, if not the most significant part, okay? This is a very important day for the nation of Israel. And so if you guys kind of remember details about this day, this is that day where like the high priest could actually enter the Holy of Holies, okay? Kind of the one day a year this could happen, all that. And this Day of Atonement, I've heard it described, and I think it's good, is kind of like to describe it as kind of like the grand reset button. All right, the grand reset button. And so essentially, the events of this day restart the Mosaic Covenant, restart the system of the Mosaic Covenant every year. Okay, it's kind of the idea. It's kind of the reset button to kind of start everything back over. Okay, kind of refresh here. And this is the event I was talking about before when we were kind of saying, well, what do you do with the intentional sins? And I mentioned there was kind of this catch-all event. This is the event, okay? The Day of Atonement was that kind of catch-all event that kind of dealt with even like the intentional sins and stuff like that, as well as other things on the Day of Atonement. Because, and you need kind of this reset, right? To not only deal with those intentional sins like we talked about, but it also, we'll see, involved the cleansing of like the entire tabernacle, okay? And all the kind of utensils that were used and all of that, because throughout the year, some of those things might have kind of unknowingly become unclean. I don't know, like they were in a wilderness for a while. They could have had maybe an unclean animal wander in and kind of get on some of the stuff and they wouldn't know. And so now it's unclean and you don't know, right? And so you need this kind of like seeming like this reset to kind of, again, cleanse everything and kind of start everything fresh every year, right? Is kind of that idea. And so kind of keep that in mind, right? It's this reset. And so kind of this process that went along here, this involved these four animals. We have like a bull being used, two goats, and a ram. Okay, so the bull is kind of first offered here for the high priest as a sin offering to cleanse him and make him ready to perform all the other sacrifices. And again, this is kind of like when they originally were consecrated. They sacrificed a bull, and again, it's like this kind of reset that's happening. And so they kind of do this again. So the high priest offers this sacrifice, the sin offering of the bull, and then he also puts some incense on the altar before the Lord, and he takes the blood of the bull and sprinkles it on the Ark of the Covenant, on the mercy seat, in the Holy of Holies. Okay, and so again, this is where the one day a year he could go in, only him, right, and can go in and do this. And so sprinkles the blood on the Ark of the Covenant, and then he would take one of the goats and offer it as a sin offering for the rest of the people, so for the nation, offer the sin offering, and he would take the blood of that goat and sprinkle it on the Ark of the Covenant, the mercy seat again, just as he did with the bull's blood. But then he would also sprinkle it all over the tabernacle to cleanse all of the like different things, right? The utensils, all that different stuff, as I mentioned before. So again, remember, this is kind of resetting everything. It's cleansing everything, starting everything fresh. And then after all that was done, and all that's kind of cleansed, in order to show kind of the permanence of this removal of sin and this cleansing, you have the other goat offered as what we call like the scapegoat. Maybe you guys have heard of that. Kind of scapegoat here. And so what would happen is the high priest would lay his hands on the goat and confess all the sin of the nation. And then again, that kind of idea, linking them, their sins are now on that animal kind of a thing. And then they would send the goat out of the camp. Okay. And again, symbolizing kind of that removal of their sin. And so a person would lead the goat. They wouldn't just say like, go, goat, like, go for it, right? Like someone would lead it out to kind of a far off place. Some people even suggested they might like throw it off a cliff because you don't want your scapegoat goat like wandering back in. Like, wait, that had our sin on it, right? Like all that, he just comes back in. Like, no, they want to make sure it doesn't come back. And so kind of deal with him that. And so then some of the people wash after all these things, and then they offer the ram as a burnt offering, which again has that idea of being wholly dedicated to the Lord. And so we see this again, this kind of grand reset. Everything is cleansed. They are now wholly devoted to the Lord. Everything's good to go. Okay. And so the Day of Atonement really shows how the system, like this Mosaic Covenant, the whole system needs to kind of like begin and be reset. All right. And then you can start to understand when you think of it this way a little bit here of why in the New Testament you then have writers using kind of Day of Atonement language in reference to Jesus. Okay, like Romans 3:25, Paul uses the word propitiation, which that's the kind of Greek word used here in chapter 16 of Leviticus in reference to the mercy seat. That's kind of being sprinkled blood and all that. And so we need to make this connection because is the Day of Atonement, as we're just talking about, is it just about dealing with sin? No. It's what? It's kind of restarting the whole system, right? I said it was like the grand reset button, okay? It's restarting the whole system. And so when Jesus, in a sense, had his like Day of Atonement, he didn't just buy us the forgiveness of sins. He did what? He started a whole new system, which is what? The new covenant. Okay, so you see all that unfolding here. Okay, does that make sense? Tracking? Okay. All right, so very significant day here in Israel's history. Okay, let's try to finish out Leviticus real quick before we do our break. All right, so laws concerning personal holiness. So next many chapters, again, show that even in your personal life, you need to be holy. And so many different aspects of your life are addressed, in these chapters. It affects the place where you offer sacrifices. It affects that. You have laws concerning blood, which, again, it affects how you handle blood, because, like, in that you're kind of to have reverence for what God has used to symbolize life, okay? Chapter 18, you have laws concerning sexual relations, and so Israel will be distinct from the rest of the world in their sexual ethics, and I don't have time to go into detail of all this, but kind of the whole point that in this process, they are pointing people back to what? To creation. Okay, if you remember back in Genesis, when we talked about that, it's about that husband and wife becoming one flesh. And really, at the center of all these prohibitions in chapter 18 of Leviticus, each one is kind of a distortion of that paradigm of creation. Okay? And that's kind of the root thing where, again, Israel is putting on display, like, we can get back to creation. We can get back that relationship with God. And so they're pointing people back, and we'll see that even in their sexual ethics. Chapter 19, that's where we again have this kind of idea of that verse I mentioned, that this call of you are to be holy because the Lord your God is holy. We also have in that chapter the command to love your neighbor as yourself. So again, those kind of aspects on display there. Chapter 20 is this punishment for kind of various punishments for disobedience, of kind of what is the punishment to be rendered for disobeying or different going against God's commands. And you'll continually see this repetition of the punishment being death, that really death is the only punishment. And so again, the basis for this is all rooted in God's holiness, okay, and the demand for his people to be holy, okay? And then you have regulations for the priests. So main idea is, again, those who serve the Lord must be holy. And they have a high standard of holiness because they are supposed to be those mediators between God and people. So they are held to a high standard. And real quick, just one thing to, I don't know, for kicks and giggles to point out. In chapter 21, verse 10, kind of an interesting thing to note here. In this chapter, it talks about part of this consecration, like the priest who is chief among his brothers, so like the high priest. We have this instruction for him of on whose head the anointing oil is poured, who has been consecrated to wear the garment, shall not let the hair of his head hang loose, nor tear his clothes. Okay, so you have this kind of random thing here of like the high priest is never supposed to tear his clothes. That's kind of a law for him. If you kind of, again, remember later on, New Testament, Jesus, as he's standing before Caiaphas, kind of on trial, and you remember, he kind of asks him, are you the Son of God? And Jesus says, like, you have said so. You remember what Caiaphas does? Tore his clothes, right? And he's kind of like, you've heard it. He's blasphemed and all that. And what's kind of the irony there is in tearing his clothes, he's the one actually sinning, not Jesus, right? He's like kind of the one blaspheming, not Jesus. And so just, yeah, side note there for that. So interesting. All right, and then chapter 23, we have these religious feasts, so kind of different holy days that they're supposed to observe. And again, kind of the main point is that even your time is supposed to be holy because it reflects God's agenda, okay? This is really going to, these feasts kind of shape Israel's yearly calendar. And so again, which shows that God has control over Israel's time. And even though this chapter kind of mentions more kind of the three main feasts of Israel's time, as we see like later on, like in Deuteronomy and everything, are the Passover, the Feast of Weeks, which is also known as Pentecost, and then the Feast of Booths. Okay, the Feast of Booths. So Passover, Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost, and the Feast of Booths. Those are kind of like the three main feasts that Israel is to observe. And what you have to understand with these three kind of main days here, or events, feasts, is they kind of reflect on Israel's past while also tying into their present. Okay, and so like the Passover, we saw that last time with like Exodus, the Exodus and all that. And that was that like, that kind of began the harvest. And so kind of also reflected on God's redemption, as we saw like in their past and everything. The Feast of Weeks, which is Pentecost, was kind of at the first fruits of the harvest and celebrated God's provision of the harvest with the hope that there would be more to come, that kind of idea. And then the Feast of Booths kind of marked the completion of the harvest and reflected on God's provision in the wilderness when they lived in booths. And so they're celebrating the Lord's faithfulness and kind of completing the harvest every year, just like he was faithful to complete the Exodus. Okay, so that's kind of this connection. So all their feasts had, yeah, they reflected back, but they also tied into the present. But these feasts also seem to have kind of a future aspect as well. They tie into events later on. And so, for example, like what significant event later happened on like a Passover? Yeah, the crucifixion, right? Jesus died on Passover. Okay. Then do you guys remember what happened on Pentecost, the Feast of Weeks? Yeah, it's kind of like the birth of the church, right? The birth of the church. That's when the Holy Spirit came on, Acts 2, all that. And remember that celebrates like first fruits. And remember James, in James chapter 1, refers to kind of early believers as what? The first fruits. Okay, see that connection? And then the Feast of Booths, that connection actually hasn't happened yet. Okay, that hasn't happened yet. If you look like in the Old Testament, specifically like Zechariah chapter 14, when God really and finally brings Israel back from exile, where essentially the Lord is reigning on earth, establishing his earthly kingdom, which we would call like the millennial kingdom and all that. When God does that, Zechariah 14 mentions that they will then celebrate the Feast of Booths at that time to show just like God was faithful to bring his people home the first time, he'll be faithful to do it again permanently. Okay. And that's why, if you remember, like in the Gospels with the Transfiguration, remember that when Peter and all them and they see Jesus transfigured and then Moses and Elijah with them and all that. And you remember like Peter where he's like, should I build some booths? And you're kind of like, that's weird. Like, why would you? Like, yeah, I want to build some tents. Like, let me help you out. And it's because of this, right? Because why did he say that? Because what? He thought like the kingdom is here, right? Christ is like in his glory. Like the kingdom has come. Like he thought like this is like he's bringing Israel back for good. This is that event that Zechariah was talking about. So we need to celebrate the Feast of Booths. This is it. And so that's why he said what he said, right? He's not crazy, right? It's not just like, what are you doing, man? It's like, no, it made sense. And it ties into that. So that's something that's still future. We still look forward to even today. But we see all these events, right? These feasts have kind of past connections as well as present implications, as well as tying into future events as well. And so all deal with kind of how God will accomplish his ultimate provision and all of that. Okay? All right. Let's see. Regulations for the tabernacle. We see some more kind of given there of things involving the tabernacle. A case of blasphemy, you have the holiness of the Lord on display in the case of someone blaspheming the name of the Lord and receiving the punishment of death in this chapter. You have these laws for like the Sabbath year and the year of Jubilee. Every seventh year was supposed to be a Sabbath year, which would give kind of rest to the land, all that. And then every 50th year is this year of Jubilee, which would lead to like kind of restoration of properties, people return to land, people freed, all this stuff, right? And we don't have time to go into all the details, but all right, so let's finish. Oh, go back. Oh, oops, there we go. Okay, blessings and curses. All right, blessings and curses. Chapter 26. So if you read through this chapter, you have these lists of blessings and curses, blessings for obedience, curses for disobedience. Again, this is kind of in the context of the Mosaic Covenant, the system, and we see this on display. But again, pointing out some specific things here, verse 12 of chapter 26, notice one of the blessings that will happen if they are obedient. What does it say there? What will happen if they are, if they live obediently? What was it? What will God do? Yeah, I will walk among you, and I'll be your God, and yourself, you shall be my people. And that term for walk is kind of a more unique form of that verb for walk that was used kind of, that specific form was used previously, like in regards to God walking in the Garden of Eden with Adam and Eve, as well as like in Genesis 5 with how Enoch walked with God and everything. And so the Lord is kind of essentially saying, like, if you walk in holiness, and you will have that same relationship with me. Okay? If you really have holiness, you can get back to Eden. Okay? Holiness isn't just about God having kind of like this high standard, but holiness is what brings you back to Eden. Okay? This is like, again, what Israel is supposed to communicate to the world is there's a way back. We can get back to that relationship with God. And what we see here is that is through holiness, that is through obedience, you can have this relationship again. Okay? All right. Let's see. And then you have the curses kind of throughout the rest of the chapter, where, again, curses for disobedience. And, again, you have to understand kind of the point was not just, like, to punish Israel, okay, but rather the point of even the curses was to bring people back to repentance, okay, to repent from their sin, and to, therefore, like, kind of the goal is to make them holy. That's kind of the point. And so kind of one way or the other, God is going to refine his people, and he is going to make them holy. And then lastly, you have some laws concerning vows. And so since God is holy, you keep your vows because what? He always keeps his vows. When he promises something, he will do it. You should be the same way. All right. So that wraps up Leviticus. And so we'll take just a couple minute break here, and then we'll get into Numbers.